Welcome to the Ray Harryhausen Podcast, the show dedicated to the life, career, and films of a special effects titan. Join us as we host in-depth discussions about the work, influences, and legacy of this uniquely talented filmmaker. Brought to you by the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, we will be delving into Ray's archive to bring a unique insight into his work, including exclusive audio from the man himself from our own archives. We will be joined by special guests for retrospectives, exclusive announcements and competitions. So this podcast is a must-listen for all fans of the world of Ray Harryhausen, animation and classic filmmaking.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Ray Harryhausen podcast. I'm John Walsh and I'm a trustee of the Foundation and I'm joined by our collections manager, Connor Heaney. Hello, Connor.
Hello, John. Episode 14, we've come a long way, and today's an exciting episode because we're going to talk in depth about one of our anniversary films for this year, Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger.
That's right, yes. So it's 40 years since the release of the film, and it's the third and final Sinbad in the Loose Trilogy, I guess you could call it, with Seventh Voyage of Sinbad first, then the Golden Voyage of Sinbad, and now Eye of the Tiger. And in this episode, we're going to be talking, as we do, about the film and the legacy that the film has these many years later. We'll talk a bit about the creature collection and which creatures, if any, have survived. And also, rather exclusively and rather proudly, we can say that for the first time, we're going to premiere some excerpts from the previously unreleased commentary track from the film with Ray Harryhausen himself, discussing with Colin Arthur, the makeup special effects whiz who worked on the film itself, and they discuss all aspects, and it's going to be a fascinating episode, Connor.
It will indeed. I'll kick us off with a plot summary, and then we can get into some of the many conversation points there are about this classic film.
Filmed in the miracle of Dinorama. Starring Patrick Wayne, Taron Power, Jane Seymour.
Sinbad, played by Patrick Wayne, moors at Charak, intent on seeking permission from Prince Kasim to wed his sister, the Princess Farah. He finds that his city is under curfew, and when he shelters in a nearby tent, he is attacked by three ghouls appearing from a fire. Disposing of the ghouls, Sinbad learns from Farah that Kasim is still uncrowned because of a spell cast on him by their witch mother Zenobia, who wishes her son Rafi to be caliph. Knowing only that the prince is ill, he sails with Farah and a covered cage to find Melanthius, hermit of Khazgar, whom it is hoped can remove the spell. Zenobia and Rafi follow in a metal boat, powered by the Minotaur, a metal half-man, half-bull. During the voyage, Sinbad discovers that the cage holds a baboon, which Farah tells him is Kasim. Arriving at Khazgar, they find Melanthius and his daughter Dione. The old man agrees to guide Sinbad to the frozen lands at the world's end, and there they will find the ancient powers of Hyperborea, which may restore a prince. Reducing herself to the height of a hand, Zenobia boards Sinbad's boat and learns of their destination. The baboon-stroke prince sees her, but she escapes when a wasp the size of a bird attacks Melanthius. While Zenobia enters the land of Hyperborea through an ancient ice tunnel, Sinbad and his crew travel over the frozen wastelands, where they encounter a giant walrus and later, in the tropical interior, a giant Neanderthal man. This primitive man, Trog, shows Sinbad the way to the centre of Hyperborea, through a great stone gate in the shape of a huge face. Once through, they see a massive pyramid from which emanates a strange light. Zenobia has already arrived at the pyramid, and by using the Minotaur has forced her way inside, but in doing so the Minotaur is destroyed, and the temperature inside begins to change. When Sinbad and his party arrive, Prince Rafi attacks the baboon, and during the struggle, Rafi is killed. The baboon is hoisted into the light source, and Prince Kasim is restored. Now the shrine's temperature is changing and a saber-toothed tiger which had been frozen for centuries begins to stir and the creature's malevolent yellow eyes flicker open. During a terrible battle, Trog dies, but Sinbad manages to kill the tiger and along with it the evil witch. Sinbad, Farah, Melanthius and Dione return to Charak to rejoice as Kasim is finally crowned caliph. So John, that's the plot. It's a film that came out 40 years ago, so you were perhaps quite young at the time, but do you remember going to see this in the cinema?
I do, actually, yes. This was it's interesting hearing that plot because it quite an involved film with lots and lots happening. And I think probably when you're a child, it's harder to kind of follow it all with the politics of Zenobia and her being like the pushy mum trying to get her son to be caliph. The thing which is most striking, of course, is the iconic poster for Eye of the Tiger. It's probably my favourite of all of the Sinbad film posters. And there are some of the sequences in the film that are some of my favourite sequences of Ray's films. When it came out, of course, Superman and Star Wars were around at the same time. So depending what part of the UK you lived in, you may have seen any one of those films in a different order. Superman and Star Wars opened in 77 and 78 in the States, but often it could be a year later before the UK and different boroughs in London would get a print. So I don't quite remember which I saw first. Eye of the Tiger was splendid cinema entertainment. And again, as I've said before, if you weren't a big fan of animated cats and dogs sing-songing around the piano, then this was really something to look forward to. And it really did have a spectacular array of creatures. But from a political point of view, this was a bit of a departure from the other creatures and the other, if you like, motives from the other two Sinbad films, which were quite dark and black magic-y. So lots of criticism around Golden Voyage of Sinbad in 1974 for its devilish imagery. And Middle America felt that it wasn't appropriate for Satan to be coming in through the back door or the side door, whatever door it was, to impressionable audiences. So this film very much plays to its strengths with creatures from the natural world. So you have a giant walrus, you have the baboon, of course the saber-toothed tiger, Trog, the wasp. I think the only creatures that are from the underworld or the netherworld would be the ghouls, and of course Minotaur. Minotaur, who would be the perfect bodyguard slash assistant. Wouldn't you agree, Connor?
Yes, that's right. I think everybody would like to have a Minotaur, particularly with that mechanical heart that you can control, a real kind of Frankenstein's monster. But it's true, as you say, the film's animation and the models that we created for this film, it's a real menagerie. It's based on real-life creatures and real-life animals. And of course, none is more perfect an example for this than the baboon. The baboon looks like a real animal. It's a really wonderfully animated creature. Many people who saw the film for the first time just assumed that Ray had trained an ape because it looks so natural. And in fact, the entire kind of basis for the film was from an Arabian Nights illustration of a baboon playing chess. Now, this was originally going to be a scene in The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, which was cut for numerous reasons, but it's an image that really stuck with Ray. So when it came to Columbia demanding another Sinbad film because Golden Voyage had been so successful, this was really his starting point. He thought, well, there was that scene with an ape or a baboon playing chess. How can I develop this and really work a plot around a prince that's been turned into an ape and his quest to be returned back to his human form? So from there, I think a lot of the other creatures developed, and the key drawings and the storyboards and the continuity sketches for Eye of the Tiger are wonderful. There really are some fantastic artwork, which just shows the level of ideas that Ray was having in the mid-1970s.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because we've talked in the past about how Ray always had other films he wanted to do. And I think returning to Sinbad for a second time so soon after Golden Voyage, when there were so many other films he wanted to make, it's a tricky sell, isn't it? Because from a producer's point of view, you want to return to something that you've had recent success with. But in all of Ray's filmography, he always does something very different as his next film. He never does a direct sequel to something or something along the same lines. And although this doesn't carry the same story across or same actors, it is Sinbad again, and it's basically on the heels of Golden Voyage, but with a much bigger budget. You know, I think it always surprises people when they find out how much the budgets are for the films. If we think 1958, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, in dollars, $650,000. But when you jump right forward to 1974, or 73, it was released in 73, end of 73, Golden Voyage of Sinbad, $982,000. Now, that's a really low dollar amount when you'd think a film like The Omen made at a similar time $4 to $5 million. So bear that in mind, $982,000 for Golden Voyage. And then you have Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger in 77, released in 77, a budget $3.5 million. So a massive increase, a three-and-a-half-fold, in fact, more than a three-and-a-half-fold increase on the budget there. And people often say to me, really, they thought that Eye of the Tiger was shot quickly and cheaply. And no, that's not the case. It was a much more expensive film. They really did throw the kitchen sink at it. It's a longer film. There's more animations. There's more set pieces. There's more people. Everything about it is more. And yet, the perception is, oh, I think it was a lower budget, quickly cashed in follow-up. And there is a reason for that. And we're gonna talk about some of those controversial choices that were made. But think about it. The usual players were not available. Bernard Herrmann had sadly passed on by this point. Taxi Driver was his last film. So Miklos Rocha, who did Golden Voyage, he wouldn't be coming back anytime soon to work with Charles Schneer after that experience. He was promised a big orchestra. He got a small one. So Rocha was not going to play ball. And if you're making something fast, you're not always getting the best people. You're getting who's available. And this is no detriment to the people that worked on Eye of the Tiger, but there is that sense of urgency. It could have been maybe developed for another year and could have been shined, but maybe the money wouldn't have been there from Sony Pictures or Columbia, as they were called in the day. So from a producer's point of view, it was the right decision. From a creative point of view, not sure. What do you think, Connor?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, it's astounding to think that The Golden Voyage of Sinbad was made for less than $1 million. Like, that is just a shocking fact. But what's more incredible is the fact that it made 10 times or more that amount in its takings. Its box office was huge. It was a massive success. And so there was great demand for a sequel from Columbia. Sometimes the pieces just fall together nicely, which is what I think happened on The Golden Voyage and a lot of, most of Ray's films. When it came to Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, there were a couple of choices that were perhaps made that didn't fit quite as well. And that's not to the detriment of anyone that was involved. It's just sometimes the jigsaw doesn't fit together quite as you had planned. So in terms of the music, it was Roy Budd who did the score for Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. Most famous for Get Carter, the classic Michael Caine film. I think most people would recognise the music from Get Carter if they heard it. Wouldn't necessarily immediately think of Ray Harryhausen after hearing that score. And that just kind of shows you the sometimes slightly fish-out-of-water approach that needed to be taken due to this urgency. Also the director, Sam Wanamaker, who I remember from Superman 4 and also the Arnold Schwarzenegger film Raw Deal, but he's most famous for being a Shakespearean actor and director. He never again or before directed a fantasy film. So again, this was a new experience for him. It was a different type of directing from what he was used to. So again, the fit wasn't quite there, no matter how much he enjoyed the filming itself or working with Ray.
Indeed. So you have many of the technical people. You have you have the technical camera people that Ray is used to working with. You've got Ted Moore as cinematographer. You've got Roy Watts as editor. But you're right, that opening sequence is quite revealing. So you have the caliph having his sort of coronation. It plays like an ITV drama from the time. So there's very much a television look to it. So I think what's possibly happened here, a lot of the setups look like they've had a pre-light, which if you're doing big TV drama in the 70s and 80s, you're filming Heart to Heart or Dallas and so on. A pre-light is where the set is entirely lit so that any different setup in any part of the set doesn't need a change of lighting, which is a good thing. It means you can work fast, but it's a bad thing because everything has a rather flat look to it. And really, from that opening scene, Eye of the Tiger has a slight flat look and has these sort of multicoloured titles. which when we think of the drawings for Seventh Voyage, that marvellous rostrum work around an antique shield for Golden Voyage, the tiger just doesn't have that same introduction. And Roy Budd is an interesting choice because, as you say, he's more of a contemporary film score person. You know, Wild Geese, Who Dares Wins, as you mentioned, you know, like Get Carter. Definitely a good composer. And interestingly, the score for Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, which I was doing a bit of research on this because I knew obviously we'd be talking about this today. It was recorded at Wembley's famous CTS studio, where lots of film scores and lots of pop stars have recorded. And original master tapes of that do exist, and a CD release of it was done a few years ago. It must be about 10 years ago now. And you can probably find it on eBay if you look. And it sounds really crisp. So the full stereo tracks for that exist from the original orchestral recordings, which is no mean feat, because around the same time, Moonraker, John Barry's score, which was recorded, I think, in France, the original masters for that no longer exist, so they can't do an expanded version of that score. And John Barry's Raise the Titanic, which I think was also recorded in the same studio in 1980, the original masters, stereo masters for that no longer exist. So we're very lucky when things exist. But it does feel at times as if Roy Budd is sort of dialing in a bit of Bernard Herrmann, a bit of Miklos Rocha. I know it wasn't Ray's favourite score from any of his films. But again, it was who was available. And a rather curious thing about Roy Budd, he died very young. In the sleeve notes to Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, they say he was born in 1949 and died in 1992, which would have made him 43. But on his own Wikipedia entry, it says he died age 46 in 1993, having been born in 1947. Either way, though, Connor, stunningly talented young man, and to be at that age, either 43 or 46, to have died suddenly of a brain hemorrhage was, I think, a real loss to British filmmaking.
No, it's a very tragic age to pass away, especially when he clearly had so much more to give. And if you think about that, when you think about his age when he died, how young he must have been when he started recording these classic film scores, and when he was working on the Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, he wasn't very old at all. So, you know, they've got a younger and contemporary composer working on the score. I actually find that the soundtrack to this film is very enjoyable to listen to just as a piece of music on its own. I think some of the criticism has come in for the score when it comes to how it matches the action on screen, but I think as a piece of music by itself, it's really entertaining to listen to. A lot of the themes, such as for Melanthius and the baboon, and of course the Minotaur theme, I think work very well. So I think it is an excellent score in its own right. Comparing it to Bernard Herrmann and Miklos Rocha is perhaps unfair, because these two are giants, and I think Roy Budd's score is definitely memorable and perhaps worth another listen to anybody who hasn't tracked down a copy of that CD you mentioned.
And yes, with that in mind, let's have a listen to the track called The Pyramid, which is one of my favourite tracks. And I often use this when I do Ray Harryhausen talks. I do a compilation from Ray's films. So let's have a listen to The Pyramid.
Thank you.
So I think you're right, Connor. It's music that does stand up on its own, and you know, it does transport you. And rather than doing what some composers might have done, which was, what would Bernard Herrmann have done, or let's get some Miklos Rozsa on and do a faux version of that, he very much found his own path for this Sinbad film, which originally was going to be called, am I right in saying, Sinbad at World's End?
Yes, 30 years before Pirates of the Caribbean used that title. That was the original for the screenplay for this film, was Sinbad at World's End. I think quite late on it was changed to Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. Both titles are great. I think all the titles for the Sinbad films fit really well. Eye of the Tiger obviously relates to the character of Zenobia and the saber tooth at the end of the film. For me, the movie has a really kind of nostalgic feel. When you watch it, it really just takes you out of the everyday modern world, and as with lots of Ray's films, really takes you back to a kind of more nostalgic time. I really enjoy the sequences near the start of the film where Sinbad and his crew get together and meet the baboon for the first time, or the fight with the ghouls. And throughout the film, I'd say, if you're a fan of Ray Harryhausen, the animation is spot on throughout the movie. It's really some of his best work.
Oh, it really is. And, you know, another point to remember is the next film on is Clash of the Titans. Budget, $15 million. So we're going $15 million for Clash, Eye of the Tiger, three and a half, Golden Voyage, $900,000. The clarity of the image, because Sony Pictures have scanned this in 4K and it looks absolutely spectacular. The clarity of the image of Eye of the Tiger is amongst Ray's best work, and yet when we move on to Clash of the Titans, it's a muddy and rather grainy looking film that's been produced by Metrocolor Laboratories at the time. So it goes to show you that you don't always get a better image and a sharper image by spending more money. So it certainly is, out of the three Sinbad films, I think it certainly does stand up and stands up really well. And it, like the other Sinbad films, choices had to be made. There were sequences that never made it. There was going to be a fight between, I think it was Minotaur and a Yeti, or was it the Troglodyte and the Yeti? I always get the two of them confused, which who was going to be appearing in that fight. But there was definitely going to be a Yeti fight in the Arctic, and that was ultimately switched to a giant walrus. And there was going to be a two-horned prehistoric rhinoceros as well, and that was a fight that was intended with Trog in the ancient shrine. So things change, things develop. I think the saber-toothed tiger is... it's quite iconic. And you uncovered recently, didn't you, Connor, some lovely images with Ray animating in quite a Val Dunican style jumper with Trog and the tiger. It's now my screensaver.
That's right. There's, you know, being, I think it's just natural that being one of Ray's later films, we have a wealth of material for Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. Almost, and I say almost all of the models from the film are still intact. And as well as that, we have all of the key drawings and lots of fantastic behind-the-scenes stills from the movie. And it's really great to see, because Ray previously would be quite secretive about his animation techniques, and he didn't want to give away too many of his secrets, but there are some fantastic stills of Ray animating on set, animating Trog, the Tiger and the Wasp. And many more, and we'll definitely share some of those with the release of this podcast. But as you say, the animation and the clarity, it just looks fantastic. In a sense, you feel like with Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, that's the end of an era, really. When we discussed at some length last year Clash of the Titans on its 35th anniversary, and how different that was from many of Ray's previous films. So with Eye of the Tiger, you get the feeling that this is the last real sort of end of an era for Ray Harryhausen movies, in that he was working by himself, and the bag of tricks that he had for animation were just incredible. So when you look at sequences such as those with Trog and the baboon, two friendly lead characters who are animated, who are present throughout the entire movie, and when you consider how much effort it takes to get both of these creatures animated on set with the live action, with fantastic outdoor scenery and everything else that's going on, it's seamless. It looks fantastic. And luckily, I was lucky enough to speak with our conservator, Alan Friswell, on this recently. He was doing some more fantastic restorations on some of the models, as we'll speak about soon. But he's actually watched the film frame by frame. He went through the entire film, one frame at a time, just to really immerse himself on the fantastic techniques which Ray used in this film, and which he, as an animator and as somebody who creates his own models, just was fascinated by as a child.
No, absolutely. And I think probably now's come the time for us to play one of our, or a few of our clips together, perhaps. So this is Ray Harryhausen chatting in the now, the previously unreleased audio commentary for Eye of the Tiger with Colin Arthur, Special Effects Supremo. And here they're going to discuss basically some of the on-screen secrets and Northern Lights and the effect in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
From producers Charles H. Schneer and Ray Harryhausen.
Then I was on special makeup.
That's right.
But I was also doing some of Ray's things, full size.
Yeah,
the Minotaur in particular. And I tried to do the Trog, but it was not successful. And Zenobia's makeups and her gull's foot. Donald Duck's foot, as you say, Ray.
No, Donald Duck wasn't used.
But no, a few bits and pieces on it.
Hope it won't spoil things knowing how it's done. It's better not to know.
I don't know, Ray. People love your work so much.
Even though you know how it's done. I got a few secrets up my sleeve.
I must say, in a sense, Stanley Kubrick, eat your heart out when you see the Northern Lights effect. I worked on 2001, and I know how some of the other effects were done. And Ray's technique for that, it's a beautiful effect, and I'm sure if they'd Douglas Trumbull had seen that kind of thing and would have maybe leaned in that direction. But they took a low-flying aircraft over bits of Scotland and things like that, and changed the colours. Tremendous cost, and dear Charlie Schneer got it for...
little or nothing.
Forgot it for nothing, no.
Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger.
It's fascinating. You know, you'd think that they'd only made that film, a couple of years ago rather than nearly 40 years ago, Connor, wouldn't you agree?
When you listen to the two speak, they're obviously very fond of one another. Colin Arthur is a very interesting man to listen to, and he's worked on some fantastic films over the years. But to hear them both discuss the behind the scenes, you know, teasing each other slightly in places about things that maybe didn't go to plan or on-set mishaps, and reminiscing together, it must have been fantastic. You were there, John. You were there recording. What was it like to be in a room with Colin Arthur and Ray Harryhausen?
It was lovely because... you could see with both of them, you know, it took them both back all those years. And there's a great love and respect between Colin Arthur and Ray Harryhausen. And of course, Colin had worked, as you say, on many other films like Neverending Story and so on, and had worked with Stuart Freeborn on the original masks for Stanley Kubrick's epic 2001. So, you know, a real craftsman and artist in his own right. And Colin, of course, has had a book or two published about himself and his work. But a real gentleman of the film industry. And, you know, you can see there's a real respect there for Ray's work. And Colin was thrilled to sit with Ray and discuss the film. And, of course, they both went on to great success on the next picture, Clash of the Titans, where Colin created just some iconic makeup effects for Neil McCarthy, the actor who played Calabos, the Lord of the Marsh. It was great. And all of these record sessions we did... threw up lots of interesting facts because Ray had spoken extensively in the past to magazines. He didn't tell them everything. And of course, you're hearing it from another perspective. So if you think about when a journalist interviews someone, or even when you recount a story to your friends about being on holiday, it's going to be a similar story unless somebody else who was on holiday with you can say something new and help sort of trigger a previously buried piece of information. And so all of these commentaries we did with Ray were a form of, if you like, regression therapy, where he was hearing it from another point of view. It suddenly triggered something in his mind. He remembered something he hadn't told anyone before about the special effects or a particularly difficult time on set, or a happy accident where something happened and he decided to go with it. So it was a real treat and privilege for me to be there recording these commentaries. And that's why I'm thrilled, Connor, we have the chance now to share them with all of the fan base, which is many and varied, as we've been finding out.
Yes, it's been a real privilege to listen to the commentaries and to listen to Colin Arthur, because obviously he was present on set at times where Ray wasn't around and vice versa, so they could recount their tales and remember different aspects of filming. One of the more interesting stories from Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, of course, was the casting of Minotaur, because although Ray didn't like to use a man in a suit, sometimes it was unavoidable to have one of his creatures for long shots portrayed by an actor in a fiberglass suit. So this is one of Colin Arthur's additional creations, was a full-size suit which required a very tall person. And so they scanned the local newspapers looking for somebody who would fit the bill and came across a hospital porter by the name of Peter Mayhew. Now, if that's a name you recognise, there's a good reason for it, because Peter went on to become Chewbacca in the Star Wars series, a truly iconic creature and character. But of course, his first film was Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. So without Ray Harryhausen and Colin Arthur and everyone else that had been involved in that film, we may not have had quite as tall a Chewbacca, quite as perfect a casting.
Chewbacca, Star Wars, never heard of it, mate.
Oh, do you have, well, you maybe we need. There's maybe a Star Wars podcast out there somewhere for you to listen to.
There probably are. Is that still going? Is that still going? Do they still make Star Wars films?
Apparently so. I think it's got a bit of a cult fan base, you know, bit more underground than the other films that you're interested in. Colin Arthur has a very interesting story, which he related in the commentary, about how he was approached by somebody from Star Wars. We'll let him recount his tale now.
See the sorceress bring life to the all-powerful Minotaur.
When we were planning this picture, I knew that I'd have to make that creature full size because of Ray's. He's God, but he can't stop water.
Yes.
So we were looking for a tall guy to go into the suit, because whatever happens, if you have a giant creature to produce, it's the distance between the floor and under the crutch, which
yes.
gives you to get it in proportion.
Yes.
And I saw this photograph in the Evening Standard of these big feet of Peter Mayhew's, and we got in contact with him. And then, as I was finishing the film, Stuart Freeborn from the Star Wars films,
yes.
especially the makeup guy, who did all of the creatures on the first ones, he rang me and said, "Oh, you've been using a very tall guy. What do you like to work with?" I said, "Oh, fantastic, Peter." And so Peter just
interesting
moved over to there. And,
eat with the power as only I command you.
So, John, listening to that, I think it's funny, because this is again something that maybe Ray hadn't realised. He obviously knew what Peter went on to do, but he hadn't realised that Colin Arthur had been involved in setting that up.
Yes, no, I mean, it's funny. The film world is quite a small world. You know, people do know. I was having that conversation today with people about sound recorders and cameramen and who I've used and so on. So it's a remarkably small world. And Ray would surround himself with the people that he knew he could work with, and then the very best of those people. So, you know, Colin Arthur was someone who brought lots of talent to Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. It's fascinating to hear them chatting, really, because, you know, you realise that they really are a wealth of knowledge, and it's important to have these oral histories. I think people think of commentary tracks as just something that kind of, you know, clacks away when you're watching the main picture. But, you know, hearing them isolated just as audio makes us realise that, you know, if only we'd had more sit-downs with other directors of the last 20 or 30 years. Stanley Kubrick famously didn't record any commentaries that we know of for any of his films, and I would certainly want to hear that. But it's interesting, Connor, because most of what you hear from Ray is from these commentaries, isn't it, and from documentaries and so on. But you're building quite a picture now, aren't you, of his working practices?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's like with a lot of things in life, you maybe don't realise how important it is until you no longer have that resource on tap. If somebody is no longer with us, and it's very sad, you wish, I wish I'd asked them this question, or I wish somebody had recorded them speaking about that. So this is why the commentaries are so important, because these really are memories which they're not going to be around forever unless somebody takes them down and records them. And like my interview with John Kearney on our recent show, his memories of Jason and the Argonauts are very different from anybody else on set, and probably very different from Ray's, which is why it's so important that we're archiving these and recording them. And the audio-visual aspect of the Ray Harryhausen collection definitely is something vital and something that we're really privileged to share with you on this podcast. Now, earlier this week, I was lucky enough to be joined by Ray Harryhausen's daughter, Vanessa, who is now a trustee of the Foundation. Vanessa was present on the set of many of Ray's later films and has particularly strong and fond memories for Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. And so now we'll hear Vanessa talk about her memories of the film and her feelings for it 40 years later.
See Sinbad battle the saber-toothed tiger, guardian of the secret shrine.
So I'm joined by Vanessa Harryhausen, and Vanessa was on set during the filming of Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, and she's agreed to share some of her happy memories with us today. So Vanessa, where were you when the film was being shot? What location did you join your father?
As far as I remember, it was in Malta. And we used to go out from the hotel out and see Dad film periodically out there, Mum and I.
So happy memories. Malta's obviously quite a nice location to spend some time.
Yeah, it was lovely.
And what sequences were being shot?
I remember the snow scene, the iceberg scene, and I think on the opposite side there was another section where they had like a big tank in level with the sea, and I guess that was for all the shooting of the ships and the sort of like a dump tank thing. I don't know what you call it.
Yeah, the sequences with Minotaur.
Yeah.
Excellent. And did you get to mingle much with the cast and crew on the set of the film?
Yeah, I did. We had several lunches with the guys, and it was in a hangar, and I can't remember where the hangar was. I presume it was near where the whole sets were. And they used to have these big trestle tables in this airplane hangar. And we all used to just eat together, crew and actors, and it was lovely.
Because listening to interviews or reading interviews with the cast from the film, the impression I get is that there was a great atmosphere. Like, it was a big summer holiday for a lot of people working on the film, and it was a very enjoyable film to be a part of.
Yeah, no, I did. It all seemed very friendly, and as I said, the actors were very nice, you know, and we all sat and ate together, and I sat next to Kurt Christian, and, you know, it was lovely.
But of course, while you and the actors were all having lots of fun, your father was working incredibly hard on getting the film put together and preparing for animation. Do you remember some of the work that he was carrying out at that time?
Yeah, back at home, he was doing the saber-toothed tiger. I remember seeing that. And also troglodyte. And I was asking about trog and that he wasn't going to kill it off, because he always seems to kill off the nice ones. And he says, oh, you'll just have to wait. And I was like, oh, darn, he's going to kill it.
So you had a premonition, because Trog's obviously a fan favourite, but you realised before the sequence had even been shot that Trog was going to meet a messy end.
Yeah, well, I was previously pretty peed with him about the griffin in the Golden Voyage. He killed that off, and all the nice creatures, he seems to just have to have them come to a sticky demise. But anyway, hey-ho, that's film, isn't it?
That's the dramatic tension that gets you involved in the movie. So we're celebrating Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. It's 40 years old this year. What are your thoughts? I mean, what did you think of the film when you saw it? And what are your thoughts on the film all these decades later?
I thought it was incredible. I thought the ghoul sequence of the ghouls coming out of the fire was amazing. I loved all of it, and the walrus scene. And actually, I remember my dad saying that in that scene, one of the actors fell on the so-called ice, which I don't think it was ice, obviously, in Malta. It was, I think, rock salt and whatever they use. And the poor chap fell and cut himself quite badly. And they had to pick out these, I don't know, bits out of him in this heat, you know. And so I think it wasn't very nice for him, you know. But he carried on acting. And also they were underneath a fur coat. I should be saying this, really. They had their swimsuits on because it was so jolly hot because they couldn't, you know, they had to make it look like it was cold. But wearing fur coats in sweltering conditions is not conducive to the soul.
It might have been a little uncomfortable for some of the actors then.
Yeah.
And when you, because the film is obviously on television quite a lot these days, and we always celebrate the film when we see it appearing on TV. How do you feel when you see it all these years later? What memories does it stir up in you?
Just fond ones. I just think it's amazing that these little models that you see on the, you know, my dad creating out of these molds and from the very beginning, from the armatures, and then seeing it on screen coming to life, and you think, oh my God, it looks so big. And then when you see the models, it's like, it's just extraordinary magic, really. He really was a very, very clever man.
He was indeed, and that's why we're so happy to be celebrating this film in 2017, 40 years after its initial release. Thanks very much, Vanessa.
You're very welcome.
Come face to face with the prehistoric Trog.
Come back to some more thoughts from Ray and to Colin Arthur in a moment, but we've got some more, if you like, contemporary thoughts now. I spent some time with Andy Johnson, who's a very well-known photographer, and any of you who follow us online will have seen his wonderful work photographing the vast Harryhausen collection over the last couple of decades. He was a very good friend to Ray Harryhausen and very good friend to us here at the Foundation. Andy's involved with the fabulous poster book being written by Richard Hollis, sci-fi writer, journalist and author extraordinaire. Now, we met with a few Ray Harryhausen fans who'd submitted posters that we wanted for the book, and I caught up with them to find out how the book's going and to get their thoughts on Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. And this is what I found.
Join Sinbad, the greatest of all adventurers, in his biggest adventure of all.
Hi, my name's Andy Johnson. I'm a fine art photographer. And today I'm photographing images of Ray's posters for the forthcoming book that's coming up.
Now, Andy, obviously you're an accomplished professional photographer, but you have a very special relationship with the Ray Harryhausen Foundation and, of course, Ray Harryhausen himself. Tell me about that.
I met Ray about 15 years ago now. And I knew of him, but I didn't really take it fully in. But within a few months of working with Ray, I used to go to his garage. It was unbelievable. It was like a bomb site, really. But we got to grips with it. As you know, Ray kept everything and started photographing his collection. Ray would really take an interest in the digital photography and would, bless him, would have this little white stool and sit on it and spend the entire day with me, even sometimes in winter months, which is absolutely freezing cold, especially for an elderly gentleman. Yeah.
So if anybody has followed us on Facebook and Twitter, and most of our listeners do, then they will have seen your effectively iconic photography, because all of the collection has been photographed by yourself over these last sort of 10-15 years. So shots they will have seen of Ray with Bubo the Owl.
Absolutely.
The collection up close, you've taken shots sort of pre and post restoration, so really you're responsible for creating a visual archive.
It's basically, I was lucky enough to basically document his collection, both pre and post restoration, which was fantastic. But anything from, we started off with there wasn't any system in the beginning, but we just started off with the flat copy work, which would include drawings, which Ray was just a fantastic draftsman, and then moving on to storyboards, some unrealised material, work films that he'd be working on but never got made. Then we moved on to the three-dimensional objects, which was just a thrill to do. So many iconic items that I recognised myself, and I just got really encapsulated with the whole project. Yeah.
Mike Hankin. We're photographing my posters that I had for, well, I started collecting in the 60s, mostly Ray's films, not all, but mostly, including the first one, which is Mysterious Iron, which is the film for me.
So for a lot of people listening, they'll know the name Mike Hankin, because your very iconic series of books, and The Master of Magics, which is having a special reissue, and it's three volume set. So can you tell us a bit about that?
The first time they were published, it took a little time to take off, but when they did, they sold out very quickly. There was only 1,000 of each published. Of course, what happens is that you finish the books and suddenly people say, oh, did you talk to so-and-so? Did you do? And so it became necessary that we did a revised edition. And so I went out again and I did some more interviews, and my publisher, Ernie Farino, found 800 more hardly ever seen photographs that have been added. It's another, I think it's about 20 pages or something like that to each volume, which is going to make it absolutely huge and amazing now. And of course, a lot of things happened since the last book was published as well, with Ray's passing, of course. That had to be updated in the book too. It's one of those things that's, you know, it took over my life for a long, long time. I started writing the books in 83 with Ray's help at that time. Of course, then he started writing his books, but he still kept on helping me out and still would tell me stories. And so, yes, he was a, you know, very loyal person, I think. He knew how much work I'd put into it. And it was the highlight, one of the highlights of my life, to when I took that first volume to show him and sit there. I'd sat there for, I think it was 3 hours, and he just went through every single page and every now and then exclaim, where did you get that photograph from? How did you find that out? You told me, Ray. Did I? It was just fun. I mean, it was a wonderful experience, and I said it's one of the things I'll remember forever.
Where can people purchase your book then, if they have a chance to get one, because we know they're limited editions? Where can they find these online,
or right,
where can they buy them?
Archiveeditions.com. They'd have to be very, very quick, because although orders have now closed, actually, last Monday, Ernie will squeeze in. But the thing is with the books is that they are printed now to order, because of the cost. They cost a lot of money, obviously. The printing costs are huge. So if anybody wants one, they'd have to get in contact with Ernie Farina, say I want one of these books, or even all three books if they are feeling particularly rich, and try and squeeze them in and try and get order them their copy. But it has to be very, very quick now, because it's already been delayed. It's probably a year later than it should have done, or should have been published. But it's now near here, and once it's out, there's none of the books will be appearing on in shops or online. You won't be able to buy it. That's it. If you haven't ordered it, you won't get it.
It'll be too late. You'll need Minuton to help you find one.
Need more than Minuton. No one had a bad word for Ray. Everyone admired him greatly. He was one of these people that garnered respect for what he did. And to a person, they said that once they saw the films, they thought, oh, that's what I was fighting. And it's because there's nothing there, you know, apart from Ray with his monster stick. They all admired his work greatly, everybody. So,
if anyone wants to get one of the books, go Google Archive Editions.
Or even Marshall and the Magics, and it will come up.
Hello, my name's Simon Greetham, and I'm down here today. We're photographing posters. Now, I've been interested in horror and film fantasy for as long as I can remember, since I was a young child. And once I started work in my early teens, I had the available funds to start buying and adding to my collection. And that's when I really started going around a lot of the film fairs and sort of picking up and purchasing film posters from the sort of 1940s onwards, really. I generally collect on Ray's films, but also on the British fantasy films, Hammer films, Amicus, etc. So that's how my interest started, and so it's, you know, the last 30 odd plus years.
Posters, I don't know, they've they take you back to go and see the film as soon as you look at them. And well, I said the artwork is amazing, especially on some of Ray's films, which very famous artists worked on them, of course.
What was originally a disposable piece of advertising is now considered to be, quite rightly, fine art that gets auctioned at galleries for sometimes tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and even, you know, over the million mark.
Yeah, if you're going to put it in some sort of perspective, these posters were designed just to be used as the film was shown and then discarded, really, especially during the early years of the 30s and 40s and even 20s, the silent eras. As an example, there's probably, well, we know there's only two copies of The Mummy, 1932, Boris Karloff, in the world. And the last time that came out for auction, it sold at Sotheby's for $450,000, actually, which was the most expensive piece. Apparently now that there is a private sale has taken place for a Metropolis 3 sheet with the Force Maria and no text on it. And that was sold privately for $1.3 million.
That's incredible, isn't it?
There is a dealer, Stephen Fisher, who has the only known copy of a six-sheet for Frankenstein, which just looks amazing, actually. You can't really describe it. And I know that he's been offered $3 million for that, but he's actually turned that down flat. So, you know, one day soon we could probably see a film poster making $5, $6 million. It's quite possible nowadays.
It's unfortunate that it's probably out of a lot of people's hands now. Certainly people of a younger age who've just started work, because when I was sort of started, you could pick film posters up for £2 or £3. Now the same sort of titles I was buying then, you're probably talking £200 or £300 up to, you know, £1,000 plus. So unfortunately it has taken it away from the fans and the collectors. So I'm sort of glad that I started when I did, and although I'm still looking for items for my collection, I'm grateful that of the collection I've got, because I wouldn't want to start trying to find them as well, not just afford them, because they are becoming quite scarce items to find now as well.
So it's really good that they've been collated in this book, because it's going to be achievable for, you know, somebody who's interested in posters to have a look.
Yeah.
And, of course, the people who are having their posters in the book will be credited.
It's important to show these pieces because they're getting scarce and much harder to find. And the artwork in them, there were serious artists working on these pieces, or graphic designers, and they deserve to be acknowledged, actually. And they're just wonderful.
It's always hard to pin down what's your favourite, because Ray was often asked what was his favourite film or monster, and people say it's like picking a favourite child.
Yes.
But which in your collection are your favourites, and also which are the rarest, because it's not always one in the same, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, some of the sort of advance one sheets, they were sort of limited to the print runs. But I think some of my favourites are some of the US window cards. Because they're very colourful of that period, the sort of universal type period. So some of the earlier work, sort of 20 million miles to Earth, It Came From Beneath the Sea, are a wonderful sort of artwork of the sort of 50s classic sci-fi era. But others of my favourites are, one of my favourites is First Men in the Moon, because I just think, looking at that, you know, if you saw that outside the cinema, whether the film was good, bad or indifferent, it would just pull you into the cinema, because the image and how exciting it looks is wonderful.
Now, you've got a very rare double bill for First Men in the Moon, and an interesting story how you picked that up as well. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that one, I'd sort of seen the original quad for that, which I'd got in my collection, but I was aware that there was a double bill, and I'd seen an image within the original press book. So it was. I had quite a long time trying to hunt down a copy of that, which I eventually found. And the artwork on the double bill with, I think it's East of Sudan, is in my view is far superior to the full quad version, because it's a very finished artwork, whereas the full quad is quite rough looking when you sort of look at it. So it's a lovely piece. Yes.
When we think of double bills, we think of the poster being sort of even artwork, 50% on each side. And on that one, it's not. It's First Man in the Moon, which is superior, definitely, but it's kind of pushed to the right.
Yes, I mean, obviously, when that went out, I think the double bill quad was issued at the same time, and some cinemas would have just shown First Man in the Moon on its own. Some would have shown the double bill with East of Sedan. So that was the main feature. And both of the films were Charles Schneer Productions, and Nathan Duran was the director. So I assume that the studio would have had some view on putting those two together at that time to put them out to the public.
Now, in a slight deviation, we're doing a 40th anniversary podcast for Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. I've been asking the guys here today about their memories, some good, some bad, of the third and final in the Sinbad trilogy. What are your thoughts? I think very good poster, but what are your thoughts on the film?
The film was it's not one of my favourites, actually. Dare I say that I'm a Jason the Argonauts fan, actually, and First Man to the Moon. But it's still Ray, and he's still got some technical achievements in it. But as for me, it's not particularly my fave.
It has come in for a lot of criticism, The Eye of the Tiger. I did talk to the director, and I really didn't think he was the right director, but some of Ray's work is some of his best. Everyone loves Trog, and he didn't speak, but the grunts said it all, really.
And the director was, of course, Sam Wanamaker, the very well-known American actor.
Yes,
who was responsible for putting the Globe back, wasn't he, back on the map?
Yes, I mean, that's where I interviewed him at the Globe. It's a very special day because he gave me a tour of the Globe at the time, and that was his baby. But even talking to him, he never really wanted to do the film, and it was Charles Schneer who persuaded him, really. But
it seems odd, though. Why? Because, you know, you wouldn't turn down a chance to direct a Hollywood movie, and he was a Hollywood actor. What was it? Why did Charles Schneer want him when he wasn't really a director?
I really don't know. Well, he had directed a few films, hadn't he, Sam Wanamaker? Maybe Charles thought he would bring a little bit more seriousness into it, you know, because
I suppose as an actor's director, he was very good with actors, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. The ideas were there, and in some of the imagery is amazing. I mean, with the pyramids and the gate and all that sort of thing. But the budget was a little bit more than Golden Voyage was as well.
Yeah, it was, yeah. So Golden Voyage was about $900,000, and Eye of the Tiger was $3.5 million. So quite a push up from that. And of course, the musical choice. You know, Ray always, he was great friends with Bernard Herrmann, the iconic composer of so many Hollywood classics. And of course, Miklos Rocha for Golden Voyage from Ben-Hur and so on. So Roy Budd was an unexpected and an unusual choice for the score for Eye of the Tiger.
Yeah, well, he got a lot of praise for Salt of Blue, which was a very good soundtrack. And it's a strange thing that, again, a lot of criticism about the score. But if you listen to it away from the film, it's very good, you know. It's got quite a lot of depth, but somehow it doesn't come across in the film very well. It almost sounds monotonous, you know. It's very strange, but I said a lot of people, you know, tend to put it down a little bit, but it's got some very, very good points.
I'll be honest, I don't think it's not one of my favourite of the Harryhausen films. But it's a very, very good tale, very good effects, great, great creatures, shall we call them, not monsters. So, yeah, I mean, I think it still stands the test of time, and it's a great Saturday afternoon, sat by the TV or watching it. So, I mean, I like it myself. I think it's a good story. I think the characters are great. Sinbad is great. You know, you've got Patrick Troughton, so what more can you ask, really, from a Ray Harryhausen film?
To a land beyond imagination.
So there you go, Connor. It just shows that I do get out sometimes and meet people and ask them what their thoughts are. And quite a mixed bag there of views, but all very, very warm and loving comments compared to, if you will, the published and official reviews at the time, which were quite sniffy and dismissive. The film's been scanned in 4K, money has been spent on it to bring it to a new market.
that wouldn't be happening if the film wasn't up to snuff. You know, if it really was the runt of the litter of the three in the Sinbad trilogy, then we wouldn't still be discussing it today either.
Well, it was a very successful and very popular film, and 40 years on, we're still speaking about it. And I actually find it's one that fans have really taken to their heart. In our recent episode, we asked fans to send in their thoughts about Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. Very warm memories that people had. And it's a film, I think, that a lot of younger fans enjoy as well. I guess people watch the film for Ray's animation. It's got everything, really, that you could want in it. And I think that appeals to a lot of younger fans pretty much from the get-go. From the minute those ghouls appear on screen, you've got animation right the way through to the end of the movie. And I think that's what appeals to a lot of fans. And if you're interested in animation yourself, or if you're an animator or a sculptor or an artist, there's so much to invest yourself in and enjoy. So we've spoken before about critics in previous podcasts. I know that Ray would sometimes be quite dismayed by the reviews that his movie got, but his vindication really came through how beloved his films were by his fans and by the fact that his films are always successful.
And they're always shown. You know, you can open up a TV guide any week, and you know, you are very good, Connor, about tweeting and Facebooking these things with the good folk down at Film 4, other channels. Channel 5 here in the UK showed a brilliant double bill, a Greek mythology double bill of Jason and Clash on a recent bank holiday Monday. So you're right, you know, those films are not put on for our benefit or to keep us happy. No one's interested in that. They are there because they still turn a coin. You know, there is still money to be made from these films. And whether it's nostalgia or the fact you can immerse yourself in these fabulous adventures, then, you know, why not? You know, now I was thinking about Eye of the Tiger. It's, in some ways, it's quite a forward-thinking story because you've got Margaret Whiting there playing the lead villainess, the ultimate sort of pushy mum as she's trying to get her son inserted as the caliph, effectively. So to have a woman in that lead part playing that kind of overbearing mum / witch, I think was quite a departure for most of Ray's films. I don't think there's been a lead villain, if we can excuse Medusa. I don't think there was a lead villainess in any of Ray's films. I don't know if the Twitterati will come down on me now and troll me and say otherwise, but as I quickly Rolodex Ray's films in my head, I think I'm right in saying that, Connor, aren't I? There's not another lead villainess.
I think you're right. I think what Ray was looking for was a female Conrad Veidt, obviously the actor that he'd grown up watching, and I think Margaret Whiting did a fantastic job in the role of Zenobia as this wicked, you know, it's an archetype, the wicked stepmother, but it's in place of Torrance Thatcher and Tom Baker from previous Sinbad movies. She really kind of steals the show as this wicked antagonist. But also from a kind of similar point of view, you have two strong female protagonists in the film, in Princess Farah, played by Jane Seymour, and Dion, played by Taryn Power. You know, you have two strong female lead characters. They're not damsels in distress. They're part of the gang. They, you know, they do their bit in the story. They fight all the way through to the end. And again, that was unusual for Ray's films as well, to have two very different female lead characters that are really part of Sinbad's troupe that plough on to Hyperborea at the end of the film.
And you've got John Wayne's son, Patrick, playing Sinbad and very much looking the part. You know, when you think about the posters and the images and those front-of-house sets, Patrick Wayne looks every part the Sinbad. And I think he's kind of terrific. He gives a really, in some ways, quite a 70s-style performance. It's very engaging. He's very watchable on screen. You feel that, you know, he is Sinbad. He's very charismatic. But it's a lighter tone. I think, you know, when you get all three Sinbads together and watch them in a lovely binging Sinbad weekend, it is a much lighter, more playful tone in places. Well, look, let's go back to Ray Harryhausen chatting with Colin Arthur about model making, about the ghoul fight with Patrick Wayne, and Zenobia's boat.
These are the eyes of the tiger.
I always felt that Patrick was more physical than the other Sinbad. John Philip Law, yes. and for those fight scenes, the fight sequences, was it a help that he was so agile? And
well, he was agile, very agile, yeah. Mm.
The stories over that boat.
Oh, yes.
Well, it was Zenobia's boat.
Ah, right.
It was on the raft.
Yes.
On the raft, yes.
On barrels.
This was built by the prop master, Eddie Fowley.
Right.
It was a... You take the trailer of a lorry, a truck, you know, the trailers that you see with containers on them, and he built a steel structure over the top of the trailer, about that high, so just over a metre high, and he put blocks of polyspan sandwiched and jammed in underneath this thing, and then built the boat over the top, and it was put into the sea at Cabo de Gata in Almeria, and it had some big concrete weights in the between the four wheels in the center part of the chassis, and if I can tell you, it floated like a half full. Imagine a beer bottle half full of water or beer floating in a river. Well, it floated like that. It'd go down and come up. You never knew which way it was going to come up.
Right.
it'd never turn over, but it was an awkward ride, to say the least.
Back to where legends first began, where fantasy is real and the land of the lost is rediscovered.
Fabulous. Now, we've got one last clip of a Ray to play, which we will keep for the end of the show. Just to give a bit of an update, if this episode goes out before the 27th of May, myself and Connor will be at Comic-Con in London at the XL Centre on May the 27th at 2:30 p.m. for a very special presentation, a Q&A and a short film. So if you're in London for Comic-Con, then please come and see us. We're going to be talking as part of the Barbicans exhibition, Into the Unknown. So at London, Comic-Con, 27th of May, and later then at the Barbican for an exhibition, we'll be previewing some of the wonderful restorations that that you really supervised, didn't you, Connor? You supervised those Barbican restorations for us.
Well, supervised is one word. I think watching Alan work with my jaw dropped in awe of his fantastic skills is another way of putting it, because I really just I find it incredible the amazing work that Alan Friswell has done for us recently. And you'll be able to see close up the Selenites and the dinosaurs from 1 million years BC and perhaps most famously Guanji himself. These are models that Alan recently worked on restoring and repairing for a long exhibition. So it's going to be really fantastic to see people get up close with these models, because that's what Ray wanted. Ray wanted people to see his models. He didn't want them just buried away forever. He wanted them to be out and for his fans to see them and for young animators to see them. So they're going to be on display at the Barbican throughout the summer, and it's going to be fantastic. From June the 3rd, it opens. And as John mentioned, we'll both be appearing at Comic-Con in London. It's the biggest comic convention in the whole of the UK. And right there in the middle of Saturday afternoon, peak time, John will be speaking as part of the Barbican's panel. So have you got anything special in store for Comic-Con, John? I know that you do fantastic talks, but what will you be speaking about specifically relating to the Barbican exhibition?
Well, that's right, Connor. I'll be chatting about the work that Alan has done. We'll be previewing some of it as well. And we'll be talking about some of the plans that the Foundation has. We'll be talking about the poster book. And we'll be revealing some more exclusive images never before seen, especially for Comic-Con London. And we're very excited to be part of Comic-Con. It's the first time there's been an official Harryhausen Comic-Con mashup, as the young people would call it. And it's surprising, given that Comic-Con has such a heritage in this sort of fantastic films area, that it's surprising we haven't got together before, but we've got together now. And there's talk of us possibly doing Comic-Con in Birmingham later in the year, in November. So lots of exciting things coming up.
Yes, absolutely. Lots of big plans on the topic of Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger for fans north of the border or tourists coming to Scotland. The film will be screening outdoors in the centre of Edinburgh for free on the 18th of June. And again, that's at 2:30 in the afternoon. So we'll be having our fingers crossed for lots of beautiful Scottish sunshine. You can sit in the park in St Andrew Square, which is right in the city centre, and watch, as part of the Edinburgh International Film Festival, Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, a 40th anniversary screening for free, celebrating this classic film with an exclusive introduction from the Foundation, looking at some of the exclusive images and behind-the-scenes shots that we've spoke about throughout this episode.
Now, you did this already last year, and it was an enormous success, Connor. You came along with exclusive images, and you did an intro to, was it 1 million years BC?
That's right, and seeing 1 million years BC in public on that big screen, it looked fantastic. The sequence where the Brontosaurus walks in the background, it's obviously very appropriate for Edinburgh with all our volcanic rocks and all the fantastic landscapes and scenery we have around the city centre. So 1 million years BC was a fantastic success. This film, Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, is going to be on a very family-friendly afternoon of movies, because before our film, appropriately enough, there'll be a screening of the Oscar-nominated Kubo and the Two Strings. For anyone that's not seen it, it's a must-watch for all Ray Harryhausen fans, because that was created by Leica Studios, who are massive fans of Ray's. And in fact, when they were nominated for their Oscar, they dedicated the nomination to Ray Harryhausen. And it just goes to show in 2017 how much of an influence that Ray has had on modern filmmakers and animators. So this will be a fantastic day of movies for the whole family.
So we'd love to hear from all of you. What's your favourite sequence from Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger? It doesn't necessarily have to be a stop-motion animation sequence. For me, for the non-stop-motion sequences, it's Zenobia. Spoiler alert, incidentally, for Zenobia, when she takes the medicine to turn herself back from a seagull into the monstrous witch. There was not enough, and she was left with a seagull's foot, quite a large one, which I'm not sure if that was a bit of a plot hole. She had a massive seagull's foot in place of the tiny little delicate one she would have had as a seagull. But I was a bit creeped out by that. And also the heart being put into Minotaur was a little bit creepy in the opening. So they're two of my sort of favourite non-animated sequences. And we'd love to hear from all of our Twitter followers and Facebook followers and people who listen to us here on the podcast. What were your favourite monsters, your favourite sequences? And as I say, it doesn't have to be a stop motion or a dinorama sequence. What were yours, Connor?
I'm going to go for a very obvious choice, but I think a very fitting choice. The baboon sequence. All of the baboon sequences, really. The chess sequence is fantastic. And the sequence where the baboon sees himself in the mirror and a single tear rolls down his cheek. Now, this is really Ray's acting through stop-motion animation. He's got a model made from latex and metal skeleton and fur, and he's really created a living creature from this. And to make such a creation emote on screen and really reflect the creature's inner emotions, I think is a really wonderful testament to Ray's abilities as an animator and an artist. So all of the baboon sequences are fantastic. And of course, Trog. Who can forget Trog? Trog is probably one of Ray's most beloved creations. So tragic at the end when he's killed by the tiger. But Trog, with his club and his facial expressions, just really wonderful to watch. And to have two protagonists that are both animated and, as I said, part of the gang towards the end of the film, I think is just a wonderful accomplishment by Ray.
I think, I don't know what it says about both of us, but I see you're drawn to the good guys. So you're drawn to Trog and the baboon. I'm drawn to the bad guys, including Minotaur. So interesting. I've noticed that with all of Ray's films. It's particularly the bad ones I'm drawn to. So we've got a final clip now to play with Ray and Colin talking about Zenobia's foot. And we look forward to seeing everyone next time. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And we leave the final words to Ray Harryhausen.
Is there enough? Yes, by all the gods of the underworld, there must be. obviously Ray had seen the foot that I brought from London, and then they decided they didn't like it, so it was panic, make another. The second one was fantastic, worked very well, didn't it? Ray? Did the second gull's foot work okay?
Yes, it did.
There was
did,
silence. Yeah. I was just waiting for you to say something.
No, it was okay. I didn't know you made it. The first one looked like Donald Duck.
But, yeah, I know the first one looked like Donald Duck.
Copyright in the Ray Harryhausen podcast is owned by the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, a registered charity, number SC001419-2017. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part without written permission from the Foundation. The views expressed within these podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of the Foundation, its trustees or employees. For further terms and conditions, please contact us at rayharryhausen.com, where you can find our Facebook and Twitter links.